was an era of swing, of high button shoes, of streetcars and horses, and of grisly murder. Who was the victim? Who was the murderer? Could science solve a 50-year-old mystery? Enter the world of forensic science, the science of crime, where a suspect's guilt or innocence can hang on a single piece of evidence. Suppose you found out that your mother, who you always thought had abandoned you as a child, had really been murdered. Exhibit A, a human skull. It started at a Toronto landmark, Danforth Motors, an auto dealership since 1949. In 1995, when the dealership is being demolished to make way for a senior citizens' home, underneath what had been the cement showroom floor, workmen find a skull. The workmen call police, who arrive to secure the site. The crucial question: who lay buried underneath the showroom floor? Police send for Professor Jerry Melby, a specialist in skeletal remains.
By the time I got there, a great deal of the skeleton had been disturbed. There was a pair of women's shoes. And there was hair. So we were suspicious immediately that it was a woman. Young boy, about 9 years old or so, came up to me and said, "Have you got a body over there?" And I says, "Well, looks like, I'm not sure." And he says, "Well, I'll tell you what you do. Look at her teeth, and you can get a positive identification." Boy, everybody's a forensic scientist. He's quite right, of course.
The kid may have watched too much TV, but he was on the right track. The records for missing persons didn't go back beyond the 50s, so in this case, dental information provided a major piece of the puzzle.
The denture was very revealing because it was made of vulcanite rubber, and this was a material that was used through the 1940s and 1950s.
Melby knew the auto showroom had been built in 1949.
Taking those two pieces of information, the victim had to be buried between 1940 and 1949. 1940, when the vulcanite rubber was first introduced, and 1949, when the cement pad was built.
The 40s in Toronto, the war and post-war years. Horses, cars, and streetcars competed for road space. Swing was in. Back then, Danforth Avenue was on Toronto's outskirts, a decidedly working-class neighborhood. These days, Danforth Avenue is a Greek area on the cusp of gentrification. Remnants of that era still exist in the houses, the old bus depot, and even the local tavern. Because the bones had been found on Danforth Avenue, the press dubbed her the Danforth Lady. The more Melby examined the bones, the more he was hooked by the mystery. Out of the 206 bones that comprise the human body, Melby collected 114. Having decided gender, which was easy, He tried to determine age, which is more difficult with adults.
We change more slowly as adults, and some of us age a little bit more quickly.
His guesstimate, she was between 20 and 40. Stature? Usually that's easy, just measuring one of the long bones and applying mathematical formulas. But with the Danforth lady, the best the anthropologist could say was 5'2" to 5'8", which he admitted could encompass an enormous percentage of the female population. Then there was a question of race.
Race? That's the most difficult question. There's not much difference in humans when we're looking under the skin.
But from the statistical probability in the area, Melby guessed she was probably Caucasian. The question was, had this been the burial site of an old homestead or even a cemetery? To Melby, the irregularity of the burial suggested a secret makeshift grave.
That suggested right there that I was dealing with someone that had dug a clandestine grave.
This fit perfectly with Melby's most startling discovery. The Danforth lady had been murdered.
There was a number of wounds on the skull that were reminiscent of a hammer, or at least a blunt instrument, very similar to a hammer.
There were 7 blows to the skull, blows that had penetrated the skull.
Multiple blows like this strongly suggest that there is a great deal of rage involved on the part of the perpetrator.
The whole picture was a red-headed woman between 20 and 40, between 5'2" and 5'8", with a vulcanite dental plate, who had been murdered between the years 1940 and 1949. While investigators pursued the leads they got from the public, researchers combed through newspaper reports of the day, compiling lists of missing women. As lead after lead fell through, the prime candidate became Edith Parks, a 25-year-old stenographer. Edith Parks came from a notorious family. In one of Toronto's most sensational trials of the 1930s, her father was convicted of intentionally drowning her 2-year-old brother. In May of 1949, Edith Parks was seen leaving her flat on a Monday morning. She never arrived at work and was never heard from again. Interest in Edith's disappearance grew when police learned that she had an upper dental plate just like the Danforth lady. Scientists thought they might be able to determine the Danforth lady's identity from the DNA in her teeth. If investigators could locate some of Edith's relatives and get their samples of DNA, they might be able to confirm that the Danforth lady was Edith Parks. The search surpassed investigators' expectations. They found several of Edith's relatives. They also found Edith, alive and well, living in upstate New York. If only they could get a picture of the Danforth lady's face. Melby knew there was one lab in the world which could take a skull and turn it into a computer-assisted photograph. Luckily, that lab was only a half-hour drive from his office. Betty Clark is an artist who works for the Metropolitan Toronto Police. Over the years, she has had incredible success tracking down criminals and missing children with the aid of a special program called the Computer Assisted Recovery Enhancement System. Using the computer program, Betty Clark can take a photograph of a missing person and predict what he or she will look like aged several years. But this time, there is no photograph, no eyewitness description. All Betty Clark has to go on is the Danforth lady's skull. The first step was to study photos of the skull from every angle.
This tells you a lot. It's a very large head, quite a prominent nose on the bridge, and there's a large overbite with a space between the front teeth. So right away we have really good description without even constructing the face.
She enlarged the photo so she could see the details of the bones.
And then I will do an overlay and then proceed with a drawing. The drawing is to establish to myself what the features of this person will be. And once I have a satisfactory image, then I can do research and find the actual photographic parts that I will replace as a composite.
Then she scans the image into the computer and replaces each feature with those taken from her photo files, sometimes using details from three or four photos to create just the right cheek or the right hairstyle.
The first thing I always start with are the eyes. They're the soul to the body. I always consider the nose one of the most important features of the face. It really makes the character. But there's so little information left on the skeleton to tell you what the nose might have looked like that I either make it too small, or I make it too large, or too wide, or too narrow. And when we've had proof back as to what that person really looked like, if there's one feature that's always been incorrect, it's the nose. She had a large gap in her teeth. Plus, from 40 years ago, I'll reconstruct this face, but with no makeup, because there wasn't a lot of use of makeup in those days. I asked a friend in the office about hairstyles, and she was able to come in with photographs of her family's pictures from 40 years ago. And that greatly enhanced the composite when I was working on it, because the hairstyle makes a big difference.
The composite of the Danforth lady is published in all the local newspapers.
You sit there and you wait, because now someone has to positively identify this. So you're sitting on pins and needles.
Bob Burns, a retired teacher, saw the photograph in the newspaper and called police. His mother, Molly Burns, who had disappeared in 1943, was 5'5" with dark red hair and a vulcanite dental plate. But what really caught investigators' attention was a photo of his parents on a railway pass issued about a month before his mother disappeared. His mother's likeness to Betty Clark's composite photo was uncanny. The Burns family home was only about 10 blocks from the site where the bones had been found. Molly Burns did laundry to make ends meet. And when his older brother wasn't around, Bobby helped. Bobby remembered his mother's laugh. And how she loved to dance. Bobby was 10 when his father told him one morning his mother had left and wasn't coming back. He never said why. Was Molly Burns really the Danforth lady? Bob and his brother were asked to give blood samples so that their DNA could be compared with that of the Danforth lady's. Even if the DNA confirmed the Danforth lady's identity, there was still the compelling question of murder. Talk about your cold trail. This one was 50 years old. But investigators were now determined to solve the mystery. Police told Bob the DNA results could take from 4 to 6 weeks to process. Scientists first tried to extract DNA from one of the Danforth lady's molar teeth.
This is usually the very best, because The pulp chamber of the tooth is completely surrounded by enamel, and that enamel is the hardest substance in the human body, so there's very little chance of contamination. The result came up negative. So we took a sample out of the thigh bone, the marrow cavity, scraped that, and sent that to the CFS.
No luck. The Danforth lady was stubbornly holding on to her mystery.
All DNA degrades. All DNA breaks down. So in a very old specimen, such as the Iceman, such as the bones from the Romanov grave, such as DNA from mummies from 2,000 years ago, all of the genomic or nuclear DNA from those ancient specimens will be gone. It will have disappeared.
This is what had happened with the Danforth lady. But luckily, there is another type of DNA. Nuclear DNA, the one commonly used, is taken from both parents' lineage. But what is called mitochondrial DNA is only taken from the mother's side.
That means that my DNA will be the same as my sister's and brother's DNA, and all of that will be the same as our mother's DNA, which will be the same as her mother's DNA, which will be the same as her mother's DNA, etc.
Investigators, meanwhile, had located Molly's younger sister, Sarah. She told investigators that Molly's husband, Henry, was an assistant blacksmith who had trouble keeping a job. That's why, to make ends meet, Molly took in laundry. Henry, like Molly, also enjoyed his booze. It made for a stormy marriage. Especially given Henry's jealous streak, he was always accusing Molly of flirting with someone. Sarah always thought this was just Henry's jealous streak. The last time Sarah saw Molly was the summer of 43 at their mother's. Later, Sarah would remember something fishy about that day. Molly was taking a long time putting on her makeup. It wasn't like her to do herself up if she was just taking the streetcar home to her family. It must have been a few days after that that Henry came out to her place and told them Molly had never come home from her visit. Henry was convinced Molly had run off with someone. Molly's mother placed advertisements in local newspapers, pleading with her daughter to come back home. She never got an answer. Now she knew why. Was Molly meeting the person who ultimately murdered her? And why had her body been discovered back in her old neighborhood? Bob Burns had talked to his older brother. What they'd pieced together put quite a different spin on the story of their mother's disappearance. The last time they'd seen their mother was a Saturday night in 1943. Molly and Henry had gone to their usual watering hole. His mother wanted to dance. Henry was talking to a buddy. So his mother found another partner. In 1943, even on Saturday nights, Toronto had strict liquor laws requiring places to close early. So his parents invited the gang back to their place to continue the party. At some point during the party, Henry went looking for Molly. When he caught her with the waiter, a fight broke out. Afterwards, his parents had a major row. The following morning, Bobby's father told him his mother had left and wasn't coming back. He never said why. In this new light, it seemed Henry had motive and opportunity. And the murder weapon was a hammer. A readily available weapon for someone who worked as a blacksmith's assistant. Case solved? Not so fast. The first rule in any investigation is not to jump to conclusions. Henry Burns didn't have a car. So how could he possibly have carried Molly's body the 10 blocks from the house to where the body was found without being seen? As investigators pondered this, results came back from the mitochondrial DNA test. It confirmed that the DNA of the unearthed skeletal bones was consistent with Bob's DNA. The Danforth lady finally had a name, Molly Burns. But what about the last mystery? While Henry may not have had a car, as a blacksmith, he certainly had access to horses. Maybe that's how he transported Molly's body after he killed her. For 50 years, Bob had believed his mother had abandoned him. His older brother used to joke to his wife, "We must have been rotten kids." Bob never suspected his mother had been murdered. "It makes me feel a lot better to know that she didn't abandon me," he said. "It's a big relief to know what happened to her." Small consolation, perhaps. But it helped to unburden the child inside the man.
One of the interesting things that we learn in this field is that no death goes unnoticed in our society. And we don't give up easy when we find a dead person and we don't know who it is. We really want to know who it is and how she died and who did it. Yeah. It's important. At least it seems important to me.
Thanks to advances in forensic science, the most important questions have been answered. Molly Burns can now be finally laid to rest. The stories on Exhibit A are based on actual cases. The names of the victims have been changed to protect their identities. The names of the guilty are real.